The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Thanks for being here this evening, everyone, for supporting your own practice and also being here supporting everyone else with your presence. The title of the talk this evening is Understanding the Three Characteristics through the Body. And I'll talk about those three, and hopefully we'll have time to do a little experiential practice with them as well. And we'll see what else there might be time for. I want to talk about, to begin the talk, three important experiences in the life of the Buddha. The first is when he came into contact with what was called the Four Heavenly Messengers. When he was still a prince in the palace, going out into the city and with his charioteer, taking a ride, escaping from the palace, and coming across someone who was old, coming across someone who was sick, coming across a corpse, and coming across an ascetic, a wanderer in robes. And it was said that it's the connection with these four people that kind of kindled or awakened his desire to be free from suffering. So an important moment in the life of the Buddha, and notice how all of these had to do with the body, had to do with the physical form. It was seeing, especially old age, sickness, and death, that again, in how the physicality of the body manifests that woke him up or started to wake him up. Another time was when he was actually a little younger than that, a boy. And his father was presiding over, so it's an agrarian culture. He was presiding over a, like a spring plowing, festival. You know, the breaking of the earth in the spring, plowing of the earth. And so his father has sat little Siddhartha down into the shade of a tree. So this is spring in the Ganges basin. And quite hot, yeah, March, April, very, very hot that time of year. So Siddhartha was sitting under a rose apple tree. And when he remembered this, which is a little later, he set out on his quest to be free after these heavenly messengers woke him up. He set out on this quest to be free, and kind of one of the teachings that was prevalent at the time was you subdue the mind through subduing the body. And so he tried that. He tried very intensive ascetic practices for 6 years, it is said, to the point where he almost died because he tortured and, you know, didn't feed his body, basically, to the point of almost dying. And then he ended up actually kind of snapping out of that, taking some food, getting healthy again. And then he said to himself, well, that didn't work. that didn't work, you know. And he spent all that time, you know, doing it. And the thought came to him, you know, what's the way? That's not the way. Clearly that's not the way. Because I went all the way with that, you know. And then that thought came to him about when he was a boy sitting under that rose apple tree and how delightful it was. It turned out he was kind of in a very natural state of samadhi, sitting there by himself. He remembers seeing the birds swooping down onto the fields and then pecking at the insects that were, you know, stirred from the plowing. And he could hear the men exhorting their oxen on. He could see the sweat on their faces glistening in the sun. So he was just having a very, you know, sensory experience, sitting in the cool shade of the tree, just quite happy, totally happy, just sitting there. And the thought came to him, could this be the way? And the thought came to him, yes, this is the way. I do not need to be afraid of these pleasurable experiences. The way he thought through the ascetic practice, he couldn't do anything enjoyable, anything pleasant. He said, I do not have to be afraid of these pleasant experiences. And of course, that is what set him on the path. He regained his strength, practiced, and ended up under the Bodhi tree in that fateful night. So again, of the body, this experience was all about the body, the physical experience of sitting there under that tree. And then, speaking of the night under the Bodhi tree, he sits down with that resolve to end all suffering, and he's not going to move until he does. And Mara assails him with greed, hatred, and delusion. Does not move, though. Buddha's firm in his resolve. And Mara's kind of like, wow, this person, they mean business. I'm going to have to pull out my trump card and play it. And so what does Mara do? He tries to instill doubt in the bodhisattva's mind. What right do you have to be sitting there? And of course, then that famous gesture, the Buddha responded to that question, not with a voice, but by reaching out and touching the earth. Oh, not that one. But you often see the Buddha with his hand touching the earth. He's responding to that question, calling on the mother goddess of the earth to witness all his previous lifetimes as a bodhisattva, walking the path and practicing diligently. So again, a physical act of the body. So these three very, very important moments in the bodhisattva's life all had to do with the physical body. The Buddha said, the world, the origin of the world, the ending of the world, and the path leading to the ending of the world all can be known in this fathom-long body. And of course, this is analogous to the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha is saying, you can understand the Four Noble Truths simply by paying attention to this body. Everything one needs to know about suffering and the end of suffering can be known in this body. And if we have some time, we'll see. We might do a little practice in seeing how we can understand the Four Noble Truths right in our bodies. So we can understand everything we need to know on this path through paying attention to the body. But paying attention to what? When we say pay attention to the body, what does that mean? Does it mean look at ourselves in the mirror? Does it mean draw a picture of ourselves? Does it mean think about what we think about our body? Is it a nice body, not a nice body? What other people think about it? No. When we mean pay attention to the body, we mean as we were sitting just before, directly feeling it. Dropping below the concept of the word body, because you don't feel body, right? That's not what you feel. You feel pressure, tightness, tingling, vibrating, warmth, coolness. There's no such thing as body. It's a concept. What if we called it a chair? You'd still feel the same thing. It would just be called chair or a lamp. What if that was the word for this? You'd still feel the same thing. So body's just a concept. We don't feel body. This amazing body, just as an organism, how complex it is, unbelievably complex, intelligent. and yet utterly common. What do I mean by that? Why is the body utter? If it's unbelievably complex and intelligent and it heals on its own and all the amazing things that it does, what do I mean by utterly common? Common in that it follows the laws of nature in the exact same way that everything else does. In Buddhist terminology, the body is a sankhara. One of the meanings of the word sankhara is what's called a dependently originate object. Meaning something that arises dependent on other conditions that support it arising. And then also the other end of it is it passes away when those conditions that were supporting it are no longer supportive. So this is important in terms of the talk tonight. The body follows the same laws that everything else in the universe follows. We'll get back to that. The body is, you could say, the supreme meditation object. It is extremely truthful. The body never lies. The mind can lie and deceive, but the body does not have that ability to do it. If you break your leg, there will be painful feelings in the body. There won't be pleasant feelings. It doesn't have the ability to do that, so it's truthful in that way. And the body can be truthful even when the mind is being deceived and crazy. The interesting story, when I was a young man in college, I went out with this woman, and I really went out with her just to be cool. I wasn't really like her that much, actually, but everyone else did, so, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, my God. How we survived that. And so for a while it was good because that ego part of me got what I wanted. I got to be seen with her and all that. But she wasn't a very nice person. I mean, not that I was being that nice either, but she really was not a nice person. And after a while, my body couldn't be attracted to her. It wouldn't kind of get aroused. It couldn't relate to her in that way. And I thought something was wrong with me. I thought, wow, this is weird. But even though my mind was still like, yeah, this is okay, this is good, we're getting something out of this, the body's like, no, 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 not good. This is not good. And it was being truthful, even when the mind was full of, in that case, greed, really. So very interesting how truthful the body can be. One of the most important ways that the body is truthful, and again, remember, it displays, it follows the same laws as everything else in the universe, is that the body displays what's called the three common characteristics of conditioned phenomena, which is, again, the title of the talk. And it does it exquisitely. So the three characteristics are these three things that everything in the universe shares. So there are common characteristics and there are unique characteristics. So this cushion is soft. This piece of wood is hard. Those are unique characteristics. Yeah? This is round. This is rectangular. Again, unique characteristics. So also, all things have their own unique characteristics. But all things have these three common characteristics. There's nothing in the universe that doesn't display these three. And they are change, I'll say them, and then we'll go into them more and how they relate, how the body displays them. Change is the first one. The second one is needs more than one word, unsatisfactory, unreliable, vulnerable, would be some descriptions of the Pali word dukkha. And then the third one is selflessness, or not self. These three characteristics, while we describe them separately, and they can have kind of like their own flavor, they are all contained within one another, though. One way I like to, analogy that I like is, if you have one of those cut pieces of glass that you hang in the window, and the sun comes through it, and you get rainbows, right? Red, yellow, green. It's still the same light. It just gets displayed in these three facets, you might say. Same thing. One truth, the truth of the suchness of things. It's just one truth. It gets displayed in these three characteristics. And you'll see how each of these three characteristics is contained in the other two. So let's loop back now to that initial foray out of the palace into the city, where the young bodhisattva saw old age, sickness, and death. And these are analogous, or you'll see that they are extremely clear and well-presented examples of these three characteristics. And that's hopefully what you'll come away with tonight, and why the body, because it's the body that displays old age, sickness, and death, right? It happens through the body. And if we look, and we don't have to look that closely, it is so obvious that these three characteristics get displayed through the very natural process of the body becoming old, the body getting sick, and the body passing away. So the first one, anicca in Pali, it means change, impermanence. It's such a foundational essence of this universe that we live in. You could take the word life and the word change, and they point to the exact same reality. They're just two words pointing to the same thing. So when we look at change in the body on kind of a gross level, meaning not subtle, we see change very simply. It's not subtle. How? Old age, sickness, and death. The body changes, doesn't it? I mean, drastically. From how we're born, forget before that, forget from one cell, but just how we're born, it changes, 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 changes. It's all it's doing. The body is changing as it gets older, constantly changing. Can't miss it. We try our best, right? But that's the truth. That's the truth that's displayed through the body. Sickness. One day, we're healthy. And then you know that moment when it comes, when you realize you got a cold or you got the flu, right? You know it, that moment. It's like, ah. Oh. It changes. What happened? Change just happened. From the body being able to fight off whatever pathogens were attacking it to, in that moment, the inability to fight them off, at least temporarily. And then, miraculously, we get better again. Sometimes, I mean, most of the time we get better. Sometimes we don't. Depends on what the sickness is. But often we get better. More change. Back and forth throughout our whole life. Periods of health, periods of sickness. And you could include not just sickness through like pathogens, but the breaking down of the body, you know? Again, we might break a limb or have some kind of injury, change from the body not being injured to the body being injured, and then hopefully back again. And then death. Changing conditions. One moment they're supportive for the body to stay alive, for the organism to continue onward, and the next moment they're not. And the organism, what we say, dies. Just change due to changing conditions. We hear, often we can hear the phrase, you know, the wisdom of old age, right? Often it's related around the wisdom of change. We know as we get older, we're not going to stay young anymore. We know it when we're young, but we don't know it the way we know it when we're 70 or 80. We just don't. There's a deeper knowing, and that's the knowing of this truth of change. You don't have to practice the Dharma. You don't have to do anything. Just make it to 80 years old somehow. And chances are that wisdom is going to arise through the body without practicing. How much more if we're practicing and intentionally paying attention? I don't think we're going to be able to practice this tonight. The second common characteristic of conditioned phenomena is the Pali word is dukkha, often translated as suffering, which it does include. Let's talk about that in a moment. But it's much it's much more broader and more nuanced than what we would understand suffering to be. So again, words like unsatisfactory, unreliable, vulnerable, and suffering. So, on a gross level, not a subtle level, how do we experience this in the body? Old age, sickness, and death. They're very unsatisfactory. We can't control them. It's vulnerable. It's vulnerable to have these bodies that get old, get sick, and pass away, regardless of our wanting them to or not, which we'll get to in the next characteristic. We tend to not tune into this, like, I'm not vulnerable, but we are. We don't have a say in it. There's no say in it at all. You know, we keep our bodies healthy and like that, but in terms of them getting old, them getting sick, and them passing away, you have no say in that. You signed up for it when you took birth. That's vulnerable. And we can actually tune into that and feel that and know that directly. Know that truth of conditioned phenomenon, which we are, of course, we are a part of. So that's one way to know dukkha in the body on a gross level, old age, sickness, and death. Then on a subtler level, something called viparinami dukkha, it's the unsatisfactoriness that comes precisely because of change. So not only is it the difficult things in life, like old age, sickness, and death, but even pleasant things. So let's say you're on retreat, right? Some of us were just on retreat, and many of you have been on retreat. You're sitting there, one sitting, you're comfortable, you're at ease, enlightenment any moment. You get up and you walk, you come back, you sit down, you're restless, the body's aching, it hurts. What happened? Right? Often, what did I do wrong? How was I sitting? Was I sitting like this or like this? We try to get it back, right? But nothing's wrong. Nothing happened. Only change happened. Now you can see the connection between anicca and dukkha. It's just change that happened. We can't rely on the pleasantness of our body to continue. We can enjoy it while it's there, but we can't rely on it to be that way the next sit, because that's not the universe that we live in. Could be that way the next sit, but or maybe many sits, but at some point, it's going to change. Or just not on retreat, you're just in daily life. One day, your allergies are pretty good. It's like, yeah, I can breathe well, and I'm not foggy or stopped up. And then the next day, you wake up, you're foggy, you're sneezing. Vulnerable. Vulnerable to change. Vulnerability, dukkha, being known through the body. And then on the subtlest level, there's even a more subtle level of dukkha that we can experience through the body. So this body with its five sense doors, right? The ears, the nose, the mouth, the eyes, and the touch. The five sense doors of the body, these sense doors are constantly being impinged upon. There's constant contact at these sense doors. And the only time we get a rest from this is when we sleep. Or if we happen to be in very deep samadhi. Otherwise, though, it's just happening. And it's quite subtle, and we don't really know. We don't tend to feel it as impingement, or we don't feel it as, quote, suffering. But here's an example of what I mean. You're sitting at home. Nothing's playing. There's no, like, radio or TV or anything like that. You're the only one home. You're just sitting there reading or something. And all of a sudden, you notice the refrigerator turn off. Right? And you go, oh. Yeah? You didn't even notice the impingement on the sense door and the subtle, subtle agitation of just having to receive that sound until it turns off, and then you feel it in the form of relief. Yeah? This is not the perfect example, but a good enough example of this level of unsatisfactoriness, of dukkha. So seeing, understanding the common characteristic of dukkha through the body. Then the third common characteristic is anatta in Pali. So like in the Hindu tradition, the Atman, the primordial self, yeah, the A is negating in Pali. So negates the self, not self, or selflessness. On a gross level, the body manifests selflessness. How? Come on. Old age, sickness, and death. Tough crowd. Who wants to get old? Who wants to get sick? Who wants to die? Sometimes we might, but in general, Who wants to? It's not our desire to. We'd much rather stay young, not get old, body starts creaking and hurting. Do you guys realize that? When you get older, your body's just going to hurt for no reason. For no reason. Sorry. Who would want that? No one would want that. But it happens. That's the truth. That's the truth. Change happens. We're not in control. We're not in control of old age, sickness, and death. This uncontrollability is both a manifestation of change, a manifestation of dukkha, but it's also a manifestation of anatta. How can we own or think is ourself what we're not in control of? We're not in control of the weather changing or what happens out there. We don't think that's ourself. Yep, that's me. The sun setting, that's me. We're not in control over it. It just happens. Well, old age, sickness, and death just happen. It's just phenomenon following the laws of the universe, following its own nature. It's nature following nature. How could that be us? I meant on a more subtler level, we can experience anatta. As I was talking about before, this being directly connected to the body, not in terms of the concept body. Like I said, it's just a word. But what is that experience of directly connecting to the somatic expression of the body? So let's just do that for a second. You don't need to change your posture at all to meditate. Close your eyes. Just allow your eyes to close. And bring your attention to a part of your body that's touching something. A good one could be like the sit bones on the cushion or the chair. Could be your feet on the floor. So notice what you feel. And now, notice, let's say you're paying attention to the sensations of the sit bones, pressure, vibrating, whatever you feel. So, do those sensations have a name? John? Susan? Are those sensations have a bright intellect or slower intellect? Are those sensations tall or thin? Where is the self in those sensations? Where are the things that you do find yourself as? Where can you find them in those sensations? Stay directly connected. Vibrations, buzzing, pressure, hardness, softness. Where is the self in that experience? Furthermore, notice what you're feeling is rapidly changing. Tiny points of sensations quickly arising and passing, just like points of light flickering. Even if you said, well, what I feel is myself, what you feel is only there for a billionth of a second and then disappears. Where is the self? How can the self be found in this experience? Okay, open your eyes. So this does not take 40 years of meditation experience to connect with. It just needs that particular frame of reference. And there it is. Selflessness, quite beautifully being expressed by the body. We have a couple of minutes, so I want to circle back to the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the ending of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the ending of suffering. We're not going to do this experientially, I'll just speak it, but all of you being meditators, you'll have plenty, plenty of chances to experiment with this and see this on your own. And that is paying attention in this way, in terms of the frame of the Four Noble Truths, when you're sitting and you have what we give the concept body pain to, right? When you have aches and pains that arise in your body from sitting. Anyone not have aches and pains when you sit? Right. Sit long enough and they happen. So you have plenty of chance to work with this. It's important to understand what we mean by suffering in terms of these aches and pains. And to demonstrate that, I want to relate a story to you. Mahasi Sayadaw, the great Burmese meditation master, once asked his students, "Why do you get up from sitting? Why don't you just keep sitting there? Why do you get up?" And they said, "Well, it gets too painful. You know, we have to get up, have to move." And he said, "Is that really why you move? Because it's too painful?" And they said, "Yeah, the pain becomes overwhelming. We have to move to get relief from it." And he said, "I want you to look, pay close attention. When you're about to move, are you moving because the pain is becoming overwhelming? Or are you moving because the resistance in your mind to the pain is becoming overwhelming? Check and see." I checked, and it was the resistance. So that the suffering in terms of the painful feelings that we feel, they're unpleasant. They're absolutely unpleasant. But the suffering comes from the resistance, which of course is the second noble truth, tanha, or craving, which includes grasping after, but also pushing away, which is what this case would be. Don't want this feeling. Don't want this pain. Want it to be different. Whenever we have craving, we have suffering. It's the cause of the first noble truth. You can see this very clearly. Again, you don't have to meditate for years and years to know this. It's so easy to see if you look with this frame. The teachings say the second noble truth is to be abandoned. And there are times, I know there are times when you're sitting there, unpleasant, painful feelings, you feel the resistance, and it's like this inner no, and you go, okay, let me soften. Can I change this inner no into an inner yes? And we soften and open, and our experience changes dramatically. The sensations don't change. They're still unpleasant. They're still often just as intense as they were. But what we've done in that moment was abandon the craving, in this case, in the form of resistance. We've let it go. And when we let that go, the suffering ends, and we know the third noble truth. And then we look and see, how did that all come about? How did that all just go down? What supported it? What was the path that led to all of this? Paying close attention. Sitting. Following the Eightfold Path. Suffering, the cause of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the way to the ending of suffering can be known just by being with body pain. Very clearly. Sayadaw Ujjanika once said, if a yogi has pain in their body and it goes away, they should cry. For this reason, it's such an unbelievable, exquisitely obvious and clear teacher. Pain in the body, but the body in general. The body displays these three characteristics so clearly, so exquisitely well. We just have to have this lens and pay attention to the body in this way. Why do we want to know the three characteristics? Why is it important to know them? Like, so what? So what I know about these three? Well, it's important to know so that we can be in accord with reality. When we don't know these three characteristics, we live our lives as though they're not true. And we're fighting. We're not in accord with the way things are. It's full of agitation. It's not peaceful. It's not easeful. But when to the degree that we know them, it's not like an on or an off switch. I mean, we can know them more and more and more deeply. To the degree that we know, meaning in our experience, these three common characteristics, is to the degree that we can be in accord with the natural laws of the universe, that we can be at ease. We cannot fight and struggle against them. And one of the best ways to come to understand them is through paying close attention to the body. Especially the great. Okay. I hope that in some way that this will be helpful for your practice. Thank you for listening.
I'm Andrew. I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this, but it's just something I've been pondering a lot lately, which is if aversion is bad and grasping is bad, like what motivates us to do anything, and why is it ever okay to listen to that?
So aversion is bad, grasping and bad, but without that, how would we ever do anything? Mm-hmm. How would we ever even lift a finger or whatever, right? Is that kind of what you're saying or no?
Yeah, sort mm-hmm. of, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We can do things based on all sorts of intentions, all right? We can do the same thing with very, very different intentions. So I could, let's say I could give you something. I could be generous to you. And while everyone here is looking, I could give you something so that I would look generous. And, you know, the intention, of course, would be wanting, right? In that case, wanting what? Wanting myself to look good in front of all these people. Or I could give you something based on the fact that I just was feeling generous or thought that you really needed it and would like you to have it. That's a very different intention. So it's not what we do, it's the intention that we do it with. So if we do it with aversion, then, you know, you could say bad or it's called unskillful, meaning it's going to lead to unhappiness and suffering. We can do something with aversion, or we could do something based on kindness. So the example I like to use is if you hit someone, slap them in the face, you could do that based on aversion, like the intent to harm and cause harm, ill will. You could also do it with the intent to keep someone from slipping into shock who just had a bad injury, trying to save their life. So yes, we can do also, we can do lots of things. It just depends on what the intention is.
Isn't doing something out of kindness, wanting to do something out of kindness, still wanting?
If, I mean, it's just a word, right? You could say, oh, I want to do something out of kindness. Or you could say the heart is just moved to do something out of kindness. That the intention of that act, you know, in Buddhism, everything happens based on intention. There's no action of speech or of body that happens without an intention to do it first. So what's important is whether those intentions are based on greed, hatred, and delusion, or non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. So you can want to do something, but it can be based on non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. So, you know, not all desire is bad. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
It's the intention. You know, I want to help heal the planet. That's not bad. You could say, well, that's wanting. That's not good Buddhist practice. It's not nuanced enough. That intention or that want is based on caring. Yeah? Which is a good thing.
Sort of a simple follow-up to that question that was just asked. Is morality determined by intention or outcome?
Ah, good question. Morality is, did everyone hear that? Yeah? It would be determined by intention, the morality for the person who's doing the act. But we have to have wisdom too, right? You know, there's, what's that? The difference between, yeah, intention and effect. Right, so we can intend. The intention can be a wholesome intention, meaning that which leads to happiness, but without, say, particular wisdom or understanding in a particular realm of life, it could lead to unhappiness. Yeah, but the morality of it or the ethics of it would be in the intention. But it's a great point because we also need to be skillful with what we do. Yeah.
So this is a different direction. I'm trying to put together two parts of the talk.
Nice and close.
The one part of the talk is the no self, which is one of the characteristics of existence.
Yes.
You have us observe old age, sickness, death. Science tells us our bodies are an aggregate of organisms. Maybe all of those organisms think they're having their own life. Who knows?
Yeah, right. That's good.
So that I get. But then there's this other piece, which is the Buddha points to the ground and says, witness my many lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a...
A self?
So how do... I mean, I believe that too. But then when I put those two things together,
yeah.
How do you put those two things together?
Right. Next question. We need to look at something called we need to look at experience in terms of relative experience and in terms of absolute experience. So in a relative way, you're there, I'm here, this is a lectern, that's a bowl. This is a relative experience. Body, yeah? Body is in the relative, it's in the realm of concepts. It's good for us to do the relative. It's good, we want to do that, we want to get good at that. Watch any adult with a young child. What's that? That's a book, what's that, right? We need to be able to do that. So we want to be able to inhabit the world of the relative. Very important. Both with objects, but also relationally. Okay, relationally is also in the world of the relative. And we want to be able to do that well. So easy people can try to skip past that and go to the absolute, to the not-self. Oh, there's no self. I don't need to learn how to do relationships. It's all empty. That's called spiritual bypass. So the absolute, which I was pointing to a little bit, not a perfect example, but of paying attention to your body, and you start to drop down below the level of concept into the raw data and what it's doing, which is just arising and passing away. It's just this universe is just particles arising and passing away, dropping down and connecting to that, right? Which is where we apprehend on that level, where we apprehend selflessness. So they're both happening at this, that one doesn't negate the other. So when the student comes rushing into the Zen master, into their meeting and says, I see it, it's all empty, I see it. The Zen master takes up his stick and whacks him upside the head with it. Why? Are they mean? You see. Right, there could be other ways to do it. But what they're trying to get across is, yes, you do see it, good, and, see, but it's not but, and, that still hurts. Do not forget the relative. We want to live in both worlds. So, yes, there is a being migrating from birth to birth to birth, and there is someone here and someone here. Yet, it's also happening in a way that you could say is more essential. And that's the selflessness. That's the change. That's the getting down to the lawful nature of actually what's happening here. This is constructed. We construct this out of just particles. So it's both. It's both and. I can see that didn't land very well. We have to keep exploring that one for ourselves. This is not a 5-minute or 2-minute, answer. This is our own. We have to live into that and learn it. But I think that's the best I can do for now. Yeah. Thank you.
My name's Dave, and I have a question about, I think I'm getting the old age part of this down, but
nice and close.
I think I'm getting the old age part of this down.
But, yeah, whether we like it or not, we're going to get it down.
The sickness and death, I've been pretty fortunate with my health, but it seems to really deal with that, there needs to be an acceptance of the old age or the aging process, and does that, I'm working on that,
mm-hmm.
And does that lead to more of an acceptance of the sickness and the death part?
Sure, yeah, because when you're accepting old age, you're accepting the truth of the way things are. You're accepting change, right? And what is sickness and death but change? They're three examples of change. Like I was saying, you're healthy one moment, and then the next moment, change happens, and we call it getting sick. It's just change. The body changing from a, again, now we're, the problem with teaching the Dharma is you have to use words, and words are concepts, but we end up trying to point to that which is not concepts. The truth of change. So, to the degree that you wave the white flag to one manifestation of change, I would imagine, I mean, my experience it does, I can't know your experience, but I would imagine it would support this opening to and allowing other manifestations of change. It's all change. Is that helpful?
It is. It's yeah. It's just that the...
What's the sticky part?
The death part.
Yeah. Oh, that one. Yeah. 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 And that can be such a powerful teacher as we get closer and closer to that. Has anyone ever been close to someone in their dying process? Or, and you can sometimes, not everyone, but sometimes a tremendous letting go. Whole personalities can dissolve and change into just this being of love. Why? Because the truth of gets, it's so in their face that, yeah. The Buddha said we should reflect on our death every single day to help with that process so that when the dying process comes, we can actually use it for awakening as opposed to for fear and holding on.
Thanks, Chaz, for the talk. I was just reflecting on a few things in my experience. Just settling in during the talk, it was just the, you know, sitting here and meditating. It's just always kind of surprising when the mind kind of gets a little momentum into being with Dhamma, being with things as they are. And the body is often kind of front and center, not even necessarily in a really obvious way, but just like, oh, right, I have a body. That's,
yes.
It's useful to remember.
There is a body, yes.
And I was thinking of this thing Sayadaw Tejaniya said about how he used to practice kind of in a more directed way with the body. Like he would notice his mind somewhere else and he would try to bring it back to the body.
Mm-hmm.
But he found it worked better to like see, oh, where is the mind? And I've just been in it for I don't quite know all the reasons, but kind of practicing in more, I don't know. I think partly maybe what can happen, maybe what happened for Sayadaw and what I've seen in my practice sometimes is kind of what we've been talking about tonight is the concept of the body or the concept of, you know, the body versus the mind. And like, because the mind is a lot more complex and easy to get lost in, but the concept of the body is also a concept. And like, that, I need to bring the mind back to the body. Whereas in my experience, when I, you know, when there is some momentum of mindfulness, it's different than that. I don't know. It's kind of a lot of different thoughts, but anything you want to comment on that?
Yeah. I mean, that's one way of meditating, right? Directed meditation where we're directing the attention to a particular object. And then when we notice it's not with that object, we bring it back to it. Yeah? So that's one way of meditating. Then there's undirected meditation, which I think you might be pointing to, where we're not trying to direct it to an object. And maybe avoiding the subtle attachment and desire and clinging that can be inherent, it's not inherent in the practice, but can be easily present and overlooked when we're doing directed meditation. You know, Sayadaw will say, you know, what's the attitude that you're meditating with, right? In his teaching, Sayadaw Tejaniya, what's the attitude? And it can be that when we're doing directed meditation, there can be a subtle flavor or attitude of desire in the mind, wanting to stay with it, wanting to get to it. And we can meditate in an undirected way, where we can just notice where the mind is drawn to, what objects it's drawn to, or even just what attitude the mind is meditating with. Yeah. Yes, just different techniques, different ways of meditating. So, sure. And especially, you know, this is a good point. If it's working for you, if you're connecting with it and it's supportive for your practice, that's, we all need to eventually become our own best meditation teachers. In the end, it can't be what someone else says. It has to be what we know works for us. And so, if the undirected is working for you, then trust that and keep going with it.
Yep. Chaz, we have another question here, but before I pass the mic to him, I wanted to just express, I guess, something that seemed to come clearer lately, and particularly so tonight, is that, I mean, I'm certainly experiencing my path, getting older and sick and stuff, and I find myself oftentimes now just wanting to say, oh, well, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
That's the way things are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't seem to help.
Mm.
You know, you just say, oh. it doesn't clear the mind. But
what would it help? If it helped, what would happen?
I would understand it, I think, differently.
Okay.
And that's what
I've been
learning a little bit about lately, and tonight in your presentation and your meditation was that it's not just saying, oh, this is the way things are.
It's just a thought.
It's really getting into that feeling and getting some understanding. And so I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, it's not a concept.
Have a real question here.
Yeah, good.
What do you see as the relationship between the breath and energy?
Can you give me a little more information?
Yeah.
Like, why is that important to know for you?
I do a lot of Tai Chi and Qigong. And, you know, as the Chinese kind of teach it, the energy is born from the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And it travels on the blood. And when you do Tai Chi, they would always say, you know, if you're going to make contact, like, energetically with somebody, you need to focus not on the breath because that sort of brings you to stillness, but on the energy, which leads you to movement. And I don't have a lot of control, actually. It seems as though I'm constantly being led to energy. Like, I'll focus on my breathing, but my breathing will turn into an orchestra of energy on the move.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I don't know if that's, and I often, whatever.
Okay.
So.
Great. So when you're breathing and you feel that orchestra of energy on the move, is there any relationship between the movement of that orchestra and the breath? Is there any correlation? Like when you, quote, breathe in, does that have a noticeable impact on that energetic flow?
At the beginning,
It
feels as though a funnel, like it's a funnel being created, a sort of an aligning thing that sort of moves down to up. But then eventually it just sort of bubbles out and it doesn't, it has its own life that's separate.
And what happens when you just start being with that energy and noticing it?
You know, I don't know if it's bad or good, but I feel a little exhausted at times from it. Like it feels, it's not exactly still. I follow it in the long term. I can follow it to, it can get to stillness, but sometimes it doesn't still quickly.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we're necessarily trying to get to stillness. We're trying to see things clearly as they are. And so maybe one of the things you see clearly as it is wow, this energy in the body, it can be kind of unpleasant. So you can know that. Oh, okay. Here's one of the truths of the body. That energetically, it's often slightly unpleasant. It's not at ease. It's a bit agitated. That's what you know from your experience, right? No one can tell you differently.
I would say it's coarse. I wouldn't necessarily say agitated.
Okay, so coarse.
Yeah,
so you know that. Stay with it. Keep being with that energy and see what else you might know. Directly.
do. It's just going on and on. What's on the other side?
See, if you want it to change and go away or be any different than it is, then that's aversion, right? So you can know that. Oh, look. Look at the mind's tendency to not like what's slightly unpleasant. Ah, he was right. So there you go. More understanding. Just by being present with what is. Not having to change it. Including not having to change the aversion to it. Just understanding it. How it arises.
You're talking attitude. Have an attitude about it.
No, just have clear seeing. Just being with it. Just being with the suchness of the experience. Nothing more than that. Everything can be known through being with the suchness of any experience.
Such as I agree.
Great.
Chaz, you talked about the body being unreliable. Here's where I really get that. When I'm sitting, I have a real problem with falling asleep.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if I've had coffee or a big meal or not.
It comes. Yep.
Do you have any helpful tips with that?
White flag. but learn from it. Like what you just said was wisdom, right? I can't rely on the body being, you know, having high energy all the time. It's gonna, the energy of the body is gonna wax and wane as it will. I can influence that. Doesn't mean we don't have any say-so over kind of things. We just can't ultimately make something happen. So we get enough sleep, maybe we have coffee, maybe we do brisk walking before we walk, who knows. We can support, let's say, there being ample energy in the body to sit. But in the end, what's going to happen is what's going to happen. And that's dukkha. That's that vulnerability, unreliableness of dukkha. And again, it's not just the body. Remember, these are three common characteristics of all experience in the universe. The talk is just about using the body to see them. The body is no more unreliable than anything else in this universe.
It seems like a huge hindrance, though. It's big.
Well, what I'm hearing is that low energy happens a lot for you. I meant when you're sitting. You're sitting, yeah. So whenever there's something that's very omnipresent in our experience, we want to, and I know this is like a cliche, but it is really true and important. We want to treat it as our teacher. Whenever something especially difficult is happening repeatedly in our life, we really want to go, ah, there's something here. This thing is pregnant with the possibility for understanding and freedom. The first thing you want to do is look at your relationship to sleepiness. Are you okay with it? Can you allow it? Or do you want it to be different and go away? If you want it to be different and go away, now you've got sleepiness and aversion. Now you've got two hindrances happening. Study it. Get to know it. Where do you feel it in your body? What's the first moment you can know where the energy starts to drop? How does that manifest in your mind? How does that affect your thoughts? How do you feel that in your body? Become an expert on your sleepiness. And then, a whole nother angle, 180 degrees, stand up. Just stand up. And then you'll be able to meditate. Do standing meditation. Just make sure your knees are unlocked. Yeah, one more.
Time for one more question.
Oh.
I was wondering if you could say something about relationship to the body in different seasons of practice. I know, when I came from a real somatic, a real movement foundation, and that's what I brought to my practice.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've noticed over the past few years is that, especially on retreat, it isn't quite aversion, but a kind of a, it's like, oh, this body, it has to eat, and then it has to go to the bathroom.
Yes, yes.
And then there's the toothbrushing thing that happens yet again.
Yeah.
And this sense of kind of inevitability,
mm-hmm,
that is like,
That's another example. That's another kind of mundane example of that third subtle level of dukkha, the sankhara dukkha. It's like the incessantness of it. Remember I talked about the sense doors being impinged upon and the incessantness of that? Well, this is also often used as an example of this, like, again, not quite a perfect example, but the incessantness of having to care for this body is actually one level of dukkha. Yeah. Yep. It's not a choice. We have to eat it. We have to clean it. We have to go to the bathroom. We have to do the things we need to do to eat, to cook and or earn the money or hunt or whatever. Yeah. It doesn't stop. No, that's third level of dukkha. Yeah.
Thank you, Chaz, mm-hmm, so much for being here,
yeah,
sharing your wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And Chaz lives off of the generosity of his students and people who participate in his programs. If you'd like to support his livelihood, most of you know this, but in case you're relatively new, all the donations that go in the donation bowl when we have a visiting teacher like Chaz, the center offers 2/3 for their livelihood, and we keep a third to pay for our office staff and take care of the building and the other needs of the organization. So feel free to participate in that if you'd like. You can even do it later at home. Just designate the gift to Chaz and we'll make sure that it gets to be part of his stipend or the gift that we send out to him in a week or two.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.